You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm KS Haddock, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
Yeah. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have KS Haddock. He's the author of Imagine My Surprise. KS, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Tony?
I'm doing well. I'm sipping some carbonated water, and you got your bourbon, from what I understand.
Yeah, I'm sipping my carbonated bourbon. And
What is your bourbon of choice?
You know, it's embarrassing, but I drank Jim Beam.
Why is that embarrassing?
Because it's, you know, most bourbon aficionados, look down on it. But if you drink as much bourbon as I do, you're going to want to make it affordable.
Exactly. So you're drinking responsibly, because when you drink a lot, you got to drink cheaper.
For my pocketbook. Yeah. I mean, I do love great bourbon, of course. I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Bourbon, but yeah.
That's good fun. Well, you're in San Francisco?
I'm in San Francisco. It's lovely.
I'm from the Bay Area. I grew up in Millbrae, and I spent most of my life in San Francisco.
That's fantastic. I actually grew up in the South Bay, in San Jose and Sunnyvale, and then moved here after college, which was 1990.
Oh, no way. Oh, okay. Yeah, very cool. I used to DJ at KFJC if you were into college radio.
No way, man. I'm sorry. Hell's yes.
Yes.
Hell's yes. Yes. Sorry about that. I used to listen to it. It was where the only place you could actually listen to punk, really, in the South Bay.
Yeah,
was KFJC. Yeah.
I started there in 1990. Those were good times.
That's great, man.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah. Wait, what neighborhood are you in SF?
I'm in the Sunset, kind of the lower outer Sunset, near Lake Merced.
Oh, cool.
Near Jonestown Galleria. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have a more of an appreciation for the Sunset these days because, I was living in Bernal Heights. I was living in the Mission, and the last place I lived in was the Tenderloin. And I was such like, I would never like go past the mountain out to the flats and the avenues. That wasn't even a concept in my brain. But I went up there a couple of years ago and visited a friend, and she lived in the on 19th Ave in the Sunset, and right by the N train. And
yeah,
I fell in love with it.
That's right near where I am. It's Park Merced. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, if I ever move back to San Francisco, this is the part of town I would move in happily. Like, this is where I'd rather be.
No, when I got here in 90, such a young pup, it was only cool to live in certain neighborhoods at that age. You know, if you were a person that went out on the town and hung out and were trying to be cool, if you were trying very hard to be cool. I lived in the Mission. You didn't go to the Sunset. You just didn't go to the Sunset. It was like suburbia. It was weird. It was also cold. It's actually warmer now because of global warming, strangely enough. But it was only later when I got married that we moved to the Sunset, and then I had a new appreciation for it and like it. I don't like the houses, but it was a cool place to live, definitely.
Yeah, and it's also there's that ocean. The ocean
you can
feels
walk
closer.
To it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
yeah, it is.
It's I'm a fan. I became a fan, and I didn't even know I was a fan. Yeah. This is your second novel?
It is my second novel. The first one was published soon after I arrived in San Francisco. I was actually starting to write it. I went to UC Irvine, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's where I graduated. And then I was already started to write. I'd been writing for a while, but then I really settled on trying to write a novel. So I wrote The Patricidal Bedside Companion is what it's called. And it was released by St. Martin's Press in 1994. So you can imagine I was writing it when I arrived in San Francisco, and I was such a pseudo intellectual staying at the cafes.
We all were smoking
X4 day cigarettes, you know, like it was silly. Yeah. But I was really into it, and I Tried to pedal it for a couple of years. Probably I was finished by 1992 or so, maybe earlier, and had gone on to other novels, other unpublished novels. And but then out of the blue, some assistant editor at St. Martin's who had read it had graduated to associate editor, so he could adopt a book if he wanted to. You know, you could chase something down, and he remembered my book. And then, yeah, I got a book deal like out of the blue, like a couple of years
Wow.
later. Somebody called me up and left a message on my message machine.
Yeah.
And I was working as a temp somewhere, and that was a very happy day. They, you know, ended up kind of lumping it in with Gen X Lit, you know,
Yeah, yeah.
which was of course not intended because it didn't really exist as a genre when I was writing the book. But I mean, it had, you know, it had components of what ended up becoming Gen X Lit. That said, like later on when Gen X Lit had a big old backlash, so did I.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was not great, but yeah, man, it was a pretty cool thing, you know, for a guy who was 27 to have happened to him, you know, and I had a good little 15 minutes, you know, did a lot of readings on the radio, the whole deal,
Cool, cool.
and it was fun. But then nothing happened again, at least in the novel writing success until this one. So it was, you know, 32 years later, I
Right.
published my second novel.
Yeah. I feel you. I'm querying
Yeah.
my second novel. I put air quotes on that because there's
Yeah.
two failed novels in there. But and it'll
That's
be.
how you get to the one that you're at, right? You had to fail at those
Oh.
novels, so you learn something.
Yeah, I know. And it's like I thought after having one novel out that I wouldn't have any more failed novels. And it's just like,
Yeah.
no, you got to keep failing.
Nope.
So yeah, it's just like I can't put this out there because not because of anything that I'm scared of. It's just it's not working and it never will work. Let's try this other
Yeah.
thing, and it's just on and
Yeah.
on.
Yeah. But
Well,
the important thing is that you did it again. You know, like you started another novel and you followed it and you didn't stop. I mean, that's the thing. Just don't stop and but realize, I guess, when you know, you've tried for a couple of years to get it published, that maybe you should move on, you know, which is a hard lesson.
yeah. State, you were temping in the in San Francisco in the 90s?
Yep. Well, for the early part,
Yeah.
yeah, and then later, oddly enough, I was early on in when I was back when I was in Orange County, they just started coming out with graphic programs, you know, desktop graphic programs, and I was temping there before I moved. And I learned these programs before other people had ever even really seen them, which was advantageous for my early temping career because I could do stuff that people were just learning. And so and back then, there was this thing called desktop publishing,
Yeah.
which of course they don't call it that anymore, but it was new and it really helped me out. I got a lot of good temp work as I was working on actually Patrick's Idol. So,
Oh, cool. Cool.
yeah.
I don't know if you'll remember this zine that used to come out. It was called Temp Slave. Does that ring a bell?
No, I
Because
don't.
I was temping all over the place, and it was kind
Yeah.
of just like how to like steal time from work, and also, and
Oh, yeah.
I used to write at work. I would like take
Oh,
long bathroom
totally.
breaks, and
Totally.
then I would track how many minutes I spent in the bathroom writing, and then I would put that as how I was making hourly, and I would like create. I'd be like, I'm a paid writer now. I'm being a paid writer. It's just that's how I.
No, I didn't have a computer, so like my back then I would write longhand and I'd fill notebooks and then I would transfer it to a computer,
I still do it
and
that
which was
way.
good because like it's a great edit from notebook to computer. But I did it on other people's computers, so I did it like I was working at HP at some point, and I remember like and I had a floppy disk like a five the five and a quarter
Oh,
inch, and I would take it with me and I'd like when no one's looking I'd be like or stay late, you know, and like use Word, like was it was Word Perfect.
Word perfect. I remember that. That's right.
Word Perfect. Oh
Yeah.
my God, I'm so old. Jesus
Wait,
Christ.
were you at Hewlett Packard down in like Cupertino or that area?
Yeah, I took the train.
I worked
Yeah.
there. I worked
No way. So
in around I was 1997 to 1999. I was doing sysadmin stuff for Windows NT.
wow. This was for like the tech writing formatting part of their operation. And this was like 1990, 1991. So it
Oh
was
wow.
way before then, yeah.
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 But before that, the money really started rolling in, and that dot-com dot bomb.
Yeah. They kind of, it seemed like it kind of rolled away from HP, however. Like, it doesn't seem to really keep up. I mean, the fact that they still exist is weird. I'm glad. I mean, I never had a problem with HP, but they seem like a dinosaur. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I didn't even I've never even thought about
Yeah.
it. Yeah, it's out of my thoughts. Wait,
Yeah. Well, that's probably good. You don't need to store that anywhere.
After the Patricide book, what was it about this? Like, when did you come up with, like, you said, hey, wait, I gotta work on the Imagine My Surprise, and I think I got something here. Like, when was
There
that?
was there was so much that went on between that time. So like I became a copywriter for Cost Plus World Market, where you can afford to be different. And
Whoa, did you, is that yours? Was that
it
yours?
wasn't mine, but man, I had to write that and copy it a lot. And that was really fun though. And actually I got that job because the VP of advertising at the time, this guy Mike Adams, was a really cool guy. They fired their copywriter, or maybe it was their agency, and he knew that I'd written a novel, and he's like, "Oh, you wrote a novel. You look, I'll you read this Ogilvy book, and I'll teach you some things, and you can be our new copywriter."
Oh my
And
God.
of course, I hadn't studied marketing or advertising like that at all.
Yeah.
But then suddenly I was, and then I was the copy chief, and then I wrote radio commercials and a couple TV commercials, and
Fun.
it was really cool. And then when I tried to move on from in-house to an actual agency, no one gave, no one cared. No one
Oh,
cared.
wow.
So then I ended up being a digital artist again, and that pretty much fueled my career that helped me afford all my other projects. And my other projects were being a musician and then also, acting. I did a lot of acting. I wrote several musicals actually
Cool,
for the
cool,
Fringe
cool.
Festival and
Yeah.
won. And
Yeah.
I did that for years, so I was still writing, is really what I'm trying to say. It's like I was still writing and I was still immersed in the arts. And then before I was married, I was living in this little in-law unit in Glen Park.
Oh, nice area.
And it was cool. And then for some reason at that time, I became kind of obsessed with the scientist who had started gathering evidence of reincarnation, like
Oh,
scientific evidence of it, and mostly just interviews of these families in India for the most part, and then would go around and interview and try and actually trying to find proof against it. You know, he was a denier, and then it just got really weird, and it always happened around kids who were usually younger than 7 or 8, and they could remember stuff that they couldn't have possibly known. And he started collecting a lot of them were or half of them or maybe more than half of them, and he did thousands of interviews, were shams, but then a lot weren't, and he couldn't disprove it, and that was this whole idea. So then he became kind of a believer, and he admitted that his scientific method wasn't terribly scientific. But it made him a believer of him, and then also a lot of other people. And then there was a whole, it started, his name is Ian Stevenson, by the way. And it started this whole movement in the United States to do the same thing, to try to track down stories and try to disprove them, and then happy when they could not disprove them. And I became obsessed with this. I think I read a book and there were some documentaries. And then I thought it would be a really kind of cool, weird, psychedelic theme for a novel. And so that's how I decided on Imagine My Surprise, which is, the found recordings of a 7-year-old who's losing his memory of his past life and wants to get it down. So he's recording it, and it records his tale of being a small-time petty drug lord who gets murdered by his henchmen and then reborn as a newborn baby in Campbell, California,
Oh,
which is
cool.
the armpit of the South Bay. And
Oh.
which was the joke. Like if people would grow up in the South Bay and then they read my book, they go like, "Oh, he was born in Campbell? Oh no." Which really was the inside joke on that one. But anyway, so that's how it came about. there was a lot, you know, I had a definitely was a massive a partier and, you know, did a lot of illicit substances back then. I would never do that anymore. And so all that kind of got wrapped into, like, he was a drug dealer, you know, bad things happened to him and he kind of broke bad. He, like, threw away all of his artistic tendencies and didn't want to be a writer or a musician anymore. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to make some money now. I don't believe in anything. 'Cause, like, his family died and then one of his friends dies and he just kind of breaks. He has a kind of a psychotic episode. And that's when he turns and becomes a drug dealer. And that's the rest of the book, right? But a lot of it hinges on the development of this kid, Keenan, and the sort of adventures and experiences that he has growing up with a millennial family in Campbell, California. And there you go, comedy ensues.
Yeah, hilarity ensues. It's a great juxtaposition of having that type of mentality into a young boy, and putting those characters together within one person. That
This, you know, the
must have been
saltiness.
fun.
You know what? It's kind of like doing this interview where I can't swear.
Yeah.
And you, like, you end
We
up
got
in a little
restrictions,
body where
man. We got
no,
restrictions.
but it's great. It's a good metaphor for it, right? Like, so he's a little baby, and you know, he realizes that he needs to change things. So, you know, he tries to develop earlier than other kids, you know, and he can because he has the brain that knows he can even do things, right? And so that's why he develops quickly. But then he makes a decision, like, am I going to be a prodigy baby or am I going to go under the radar? And then he decides, at least at first, because later on he just can't help but look pretty smart. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't, like, try to talk to his parents. He doesn't try to tell anybody who he was. He never does. And all that. And so that's the comedy of it, being undercover, being an undercover 50-year-old that has to deal with parents that don't really know what they're doing in a sort of working class neighborhood. And and so that's the comedy that ensues. It's just like him looking at the world from a couple feet high and then realizing that really kids are like a second class of citizens that are ignored and sort of
Oh,
imprisoned.
interesting. Okay. Yeah. And then what about the theme, like what about the belief of reincarnation when you did, as you were researching this, you must have had a relationship with the idea of reincarnation. Do you believe in it? Where are you at on it? Because I know my book is actually the one I'm querying is based in the afterlife, which is some totally fake afterlife. But I was in it for so long. I'm sitting there going, maybe this is the afterlife after a
Oh
while.
yeah. No, I you know it's you know I was one side of my family was really religious, like they're ministers, you know, like they're the real deal. And I sort of rejected that early on. I actually ended up my mom ended up remarrying it, and then to a guy that had some money. So I grew up pretty poor until that moment. And then I was sent to prep school, not sent as in went away, but I went to prep school at Bellarmine in San Jose. And it was great, but their brand of Christianity, you know, was by Jesuits. It was vastly different than the version that my Pentecostal relatives were espousing. And so I was like, wow, it can be different. And then after I wised up and, you know, and grew up and went to college, I essentially became an atheist. Or more an agnostic, because in the end, I think atheism is almost its own religion. You know, like you don't
I
know. It's
agree.
a very arrogant position, really.
Atheism is faith. Like agnostic is questioning.
Absolutely. You know, and so yeah. Like, is there a God? I don't know. There's some weird stuff going on in the background. That is for sure. You know, like. I am convinced of that, but I don't believe in reincarnation. You know what? I don't disbelieve in reincarnation. That's really what it is. Like, I don't believe in reincarnation, but after learning all this stuff, I'm like, I don't disbelieve it either. Which is truly an agnostic way to think, right? But I was, you know, because of course that question's come up in, like, you know, other interviews I've had, and I'm like, yeah, I don't really believe in it fully, but I really can't disbelieve it now. So it's a maybe.
Do you think when you were writing it that you that there was almost I get crazy where I'm like, even if my world is absurd, I believe in it 100% when I'm working in it. I don't know if you do that too.
I
It
commit.
was just, you know, it's just like this is how everything is. And then when I'm out of the book, then I'm like, oh man, I can't even look at that. That's crazy. So
Yeah, I think it's like, when you commit and you're an actor, like you want to believe in your character and you don't want to have an opinion about him that is outside of the character that you're working inside of, and I think that definitely happens. There's a logic to the world building that you do in a book, and you want to stick with it so that the book has a sense of narrative integrity, right? You want, if you believe that the people in the book, believe this world, then you don't write characters and cast aspersions to them, right? Like you write characters as presented. And there's a lot of grifty criminal characters in Imagine My Surprise, and I never necessarily put them down in a certain way. I mean, it's a first person narrative from this from their old boss. But I don't really I don't really denigrate them, along the way. They're just, they are characters, of themselves.
Totally. Was there a part of you that felt, I mean, well, we got to tap into who we were at. So when you're tapping into a character at 7 years old and you're tapping into a character that's a dead 50-year-old guy, you're probably tapping into yourself a little bit in the
Oh,
7 year-old
yeah.
you. Yeah.
No. So, yeah. See, the whole thing started out though as an autofiction book,
Oh yeah.
So the main character was me, and I didn't know it was called autofiction. I didn't know there was a genre. I just wanted to be super surreal
Yeah.
because in my head, back in 2007, by the way, is when I started this book.
No way. Okay.
I took 8 years off though, so it wasn't
Yeah,
exactly that
yeah.
whole time. But I thought, well, this will be trippy. So I'll write about this character who dies, but then he, but this, after he's a kid, he does this dialogue, and then that gets published. So is this the book that the kid wrote and then was published by and this whole circular sort
Yeah.
of trippy idea that I thought that would be an extra added coolness to it. So it was me that was the main 50-year-old character who loses faith in himself and becomes a drug dealer. And originally it was just me. I used all real names of all my friends and stuff. I'd ask them, "Can I
Cool.
put you in this book?" So I did that, and it was that way for a long time. And so the story of the writing of it was, I wrote about 400 pages of it, and I was really ha wondering how I was going to stick the ending, because it's a crazy story. And then I had a friend, an actor friend, who I was actually in a movie with. He came up with a startup, like an internet startup, and asked me if I wanted to art direct it and to be the creative director. And it seemed pretty cool, and I got into it. And I basically said, "You know what? I should probably grab this brass ring right now. I'll put down the book for now until we'll see what happens. Either it'll become rich or it'll fail." So when it failed 8 years later, I decided to pick it up again, and I didn't know if it was any good. And actually, at the time, I was working at Google, as a graphic artist at Google, and read it on the Google bus. So there's a Google bus that travels from
Oh,
San Francisco to Mountain View, and it was a horrible, very horrible ride, by the way. It was a couple hours in traffic, going and coming, and so I started reading the book again on that Google bus, and I went like, "You know what? This is pretty good. So you know what? I think I'm going to try to finish this." And so then I did, and it was around that time I quit Google and actually started working for ILM, and then I started spending weekends and always Thursdays and Saturdays I would go and try to fit and finish the book, so I'd go and write it and found it and then did, and I finished it by. You know what? It was just around COVID is when I actually finished the first full draft. It was probably like this the spring of 2020. And it was huge. It was like 640 pages.
Oh,
And
wow.
so then I had some friends, help me edit it. And which I do, like, my smarter literate friends, I'd be like, "Hey, help me out." And that's always a good start. It was, really long for a lot of people, but I had some good people read it. They liked it. I kept asking, is the Caius Haddock, like the actual name of my name in the book, is that obnoxious? I thought it was kind of cool. And they all said it was fine. And I was like, and I still have doubts myself. I mean, like, I'm like, I was ready to make a change, if it came up. And so it went very far. I hired a professional editor, this guy, Wes Brown, in London, England. And he helped me cut it down. He helped me rearrange it a little bit, and he said, this is great. It's a little confusing. I had three different timelines in it at the time, and now it's two timelines. And then finally, it got to the desk of Bernard Schweitzer at Heresy Press. It's a very, very small new press who's now they're an imprint now of Skyhorse, which I try not to say. And
Why not?
then. I don't want to go into it right here. I'm in public,
Oh, okay. I like Skyhorse. I like what they do.
yeah, there's some good imprints. In any case, they oh, then he said, I don't like, he actually rejected it at first, and he said it needs to be cut to under 100,000 words, and
But there was
then.
interest. What is that?
Oh, there's interest. They rejected it, and they said, and I talked them back into it. They said, well, the first reader in their report, because they make a little report for you, or to the editor, and in the report, they thought that the book was vulgar. And I was like, well, hold it, what? Vulgar? Like, did your mom read this? Like, whoever says vulgar anymore? That's, and of course it's vulgar.
And what's the name of your press? Heresy Press.
It's so weird. It's Heresy Press. No, exactly. I was like, wow. But then Bernard, who did like my writing, he loved the story, and he thought, you know what? I'll take a second look at it, cut it down. You should change it from being an autofiction to, make the main older character another name. And I kept the same name as the kid. And then I rewrote it, and it was really good advice. Bernard is great. I mean, he's a believer. But he's also very smart, and he's had my back the whole time. He's fantastic, and I'm not just saying that because he might see this. It's really true. He's great. Anyway, so then after that, he said, "Yeah, I think we want to pursue this," and Skyhorse did too, to their credit. And it's that's how it's gone. And I designed as an art director and a control freak. Like I designed the cover, all the art. I actually gave them a layout template for the way I wanted it laid out. And then they did it all, and so that was cool. The editorial team in there, was pretty happy. I'm probably pretty happy to not have to do the work themselves, but I mean, they still did a ton of work. They still had to set up, all the stuff. But in any case, nobody had to pay for an artist to do the cover or anything like that,
And I don't think authors realize how much they usually don't have control of the cover. So
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Or control over a lot of stuff. But when you work with a press as small as Heresy, although they have quite, no, they have like 20 or 30 titles. I mean, it doesn't seem that small. They only started like 4 years ago or something.
Oh,
So
okay.
5 years ago. Yeah, they're pretty new. So Bernard's a busy man.
It's funny
So yeah.
that
And the, yeah, what's
oh,
it?
no,
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, 'cause I throw my book out to readers at certain points in my drafts where and then it's just like when I feel like it's done, it goes to certain other writer friends, and and I'm reading a friend's book right now. It's just like it's all about the giving and taking, and it's just like, oh, now I get to dig into my fr other friend's book. But sometimes it's just one or two notes, and the notes could just be like that my book changed a lot because one of my friends said, you know what? I really liked the Carissa character, and I feel like that she should have more time with Sebastian. And I went, oh, crap, you're right. And
Oh no, it's excellent.
and then it took me like an 18-month rewrite after that because
Oh wow.
I had to sit there and think about their relationship, and it was all because he just said that. It was just the people who know just like what to say. It's almost like good directors where they go up to actors and they're like, no, don't say it like this, say it like this. They come up and they whisper something that's just like two words of, and it's some
Think of the
genius.
way you're Think of the way your mom lied to you that one time. Okay, now go.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I did the same thing. I have a buddy, Ricardo Zagre. In fact, he's just finished a memoir that'll come out sometime. I'm sure somebody will pick it up. Great writer, really good friend of mine. Great, fantastic musician, overall crazy man. But he was the second person to read it and really give me thoughtful edits, like sometimes line edits and stuff like that. But a lot of it was just more like keeping me honest, like, this doesn't sound like something that you would even write. Why did you write? Why did you write this turn of phrase? Or and he was really good at that. He was very honest, and but also dug it. He dug the book a lot. And you get, one of them was like when I in my first ending. Well, it was always the same ending, but it was not as violent as it is now. But there's a lot of readers who, and imagine my surprise, Keenan sort of he becomes what seems like the his raison d'etre of being reincarnated is perhaps to learn something from the mistakes he made, which sounds cliche a little bit, but it was mostly true. I didn't do this reincarnation story for that lesson, because in the original version of time or arc of it, I wanted him to seek revenge, and this is why I couldn't figure out the ending. I wanted him to seek revenge and possibly have a, a big old bloody massacre at the end of the book from a 5-year-old, or and the people that he hired or something. And that was, my intent for a while before that 8-year break. And during that 8 years, I got married and had a child. So that was really it informed so much, like to write about a newborn when you've never had a newborn, which is the early part of this book. I did a lot of research and stuff, and just I have a psych degree, so there was a lot of child development classes and stuff in that. But I didn't know. And then after I had a kid, it sort of informed me when I started up the book again. But then also, I don't know, it seemed like it would be silly for him to be the same person at the end of the book as he was when he was alive. So it ended up doing this. But that didn't mean there wasn't a good chance for some good old violence and blood, which is definitely what happens at the end, but it's just not the way you think. And,
So you act in films as well, in commercials?
I this is very amateur level, but like in all Bay Area, I was friends with a lot of people in ad agencies, so if they needed an extra to come in, and they knew that I had some chops. I mean, I did like local theater for a long time,
And
and
commercial
then I
extras make good money.
they make well, depends on the commercial. Like the commercials that I was always a part of in was more of a non-union. If you're in the union, then you're gonna get money throughout the lifetime of the commercial. But if you're doing this kind of stuff, you get a check, for a couple hundred dollars or something. But at some point, I never I did not know anything about film, but I decided that I was going to film my own independent film, and did, and it wasn't good. But it taught me a lot about putting a project together, actually, which helped later on, and also how to, manage actors and all that. I directed it, it was, and which is funny about it, it was a rewrite of No Exit, the play No Exit. It was a modernization of it, and which was, I was obsessed with that play, and I did it. It turned out really bad. It's relatively unwatchable. But then later on, I started to write musicals because I'm a longtime musician. I was a musician before I was a writer. I've been playing since I was a teenager, and then I started writing these musicals for the San Francisco Fringe Festival. And all my friends did because we were all freaks like that. And then I rewrote my own movie into a musical called Hell the Musical, and we won like best musical. It was really funny. Like I finally had success. I just had to totally rewrite it and make it a comedy,
And at the same
after
time, you also
that.
got the film chops where you got a you've found your way through shooting a film. It probably helped a lot when you're working on the musical in a theater situation where.
Definitely. I've been on the stage quite a bit by that time, and I did a musical previous to that called Fanatics, which was yet another fail, was from a failed novel that I'd written, and I made
Okay.
that into, I just basically, rehash other stuff that was horrible, trying to make
Yeah.
it better
Oh,
by changing the whole idea of it. So Fanatics actually won too, and then that was that, and that helped me out with Hell the Musical, because that came a few years later, and then I really knew what I was doing because I'd already done the Fringe Festival. And then I did it one last one in 2017 called Hitler in the Green Room at the Fringe Festival, and it was about, and it was my, you might, it's my favorite definitely, and the most developed probably. It was about how Hitler dies on the eve of the Nuremberg rally, the first ones where he started really taking off in Germany, and Nazism really started. He dies, and then all of his henchmen, like Goebbels and hell, Reni Riefenstahl and all those cats. They know a gay Hitler impersonator, down in Berlin that they can kidnap and stand him up as the Hitler for the rally the next day. So that is the musical,
Oh, how
and
much fun
they
is
do
that?
they. It was fun. It was pretty frightening because it was also the same summer as the Charlottesville riot. So, having costumes, having Nazi costumes was fraught at that time. Not that it's not always fraught, but it was cool, and we leaned into it and had a really great time. Wrote a bunch of great music, and it was I used all my friends in it, and they're all experienced actors, like fantastic actors. And we won again, and so that was my last foray into musicals.
That's fantastic. I love Fringe Fest. Like when I was up there, I'd have actor friends or whatever just
Oh
pop in
yeah.
and see the plays, and it's just there. It's
Crazy
great.
stuff.
It's great.
It's funny, like it was almost like hackneyed to like do a show where Hitler was involved. Because like that's what Fringe Fest does. They'll take the hardest thing to palate, and then they'll make a joke about it, and that it'll become a whole play at the Fringe Festival. And that was definitely something like that. I'd had that story in my head for years, and in the original of it, I think it was more serious. But then I was like, I just realized that we had to lampoon it. That's the only way you can get, you can pull off of any show about Hitler. It has to be funny.
Cut. What wasn't that the producers? What was that? What was that? Was
Yeah,
that Springtime for
yeah, yeah,
Hitler?
uh, yeah, yeah. I think that's what it was. The thing is, I'm not Jewish, so like there was a for a second, I'm like, don't you have to be Jewish to really pull off a Hitler show? So that it doesn't seem like, you're giving any sort of credit to it. And I was like, no, I think we're pretty safe by now. I mean, a drag queen Hitler has to be, acceptable. I would
It's
imagine.
it's so much fun. It's so much fun. It's great. That's the beauty of it. You just get it. You get in the creative juice, and you're like, what's the angle? What is the angle? And then how do we pull it off? And especially the how do we pull it off? Like even with your book, I'm sure there was many times where you're like, how do I pull this off? Because the idea is like grandiose, and you got to bring it down to a narrative. And that's the fun puzzle of it all. It's like, this shouldn't work. This shouldn't work, and then you make it work. It's
Yeah, it was especially to imagine my surprise. A lot of people have said that since they read it, and they're like, it's so good, it's so readable, it's a really quick read. I really wanted to read it, all the way through, really fast. And then a lot of the comments are like, I can't believe you even pulled this off,
yeah.
because it seems super crazy. But then when you're reading it, it doesn't seem crazy. It just seems like a fun book, with a lot of very serious, dark moments in it. But And then the fact that I make the ending at a luxury suite at a Giants ball game, I'm not even really a baseball fan that much, but I thought that is weird. And somehow the logic of the story brought me to that place, and that's how I stuck the ending, right? Like, I didn't know what my ending was, and then as I wrote the book, somehow I ended up making it at a Giants luxury suite during a baseball game.
I grew up in Millbrae, which was kind of close to Candlestick Park, so that was That and plus, like all through school, like even when I went, like even in junior high, we in PE we had to take tests about the players on the Giants, and it's just like we just knew they like they it was a cult almost. So when they finally got to the World, man, that 2010 World Series, I was still living in the Tenderloin. I was on Geary and Polk, and
Okay.
it
I love
just.
that neighborhood.
Yeah, oh, that was back when the Hemlock was still there and all that,
Oh
you
yeah.
know.
No, I love that place, man.
Yeah, and but man, when they clinched, and I was at Whiskey Thieves when they clinched, and it just like it just traffic stopped. A fire truck came down around the corner, and I thought they were trying to do crowd control. Oh no, they had on their loudspeaker, "Let's go Giants," and they just blocked everything too. It's just like
I
it was
remember
beautiful.
traveling someplace. I don't even know if I watched that, whatever the final game of the series was. But I was on the road, like in town, and it was mayhem. It was
Oh.
fireworks, explosions, people in the street. It was massive. Yeah, I remember
It
that.
was the first win since they came to San Francisco. It's
Yeah.
just like
Oh,
this
was
isn't,
it?
yeah, it's like this wasn't
Yeah.
supposed to happen. We're not that good. We're never that good.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's good. I didn't know that. I thought that they had won previously,
No, the
but then they had
first
a great
one.
run, and then now they're not
Yeah.
having a good run anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now it's I don't know what's going on. We're everyone was all
Rebuilding.
rebuilding. That's the key
Real,
word. That's the
we're
key word to
rebuilding.
keep your job. I'm
Yeah, there's a, no,
rebuilding.
we have to go through this so we can get to the other place. We're rebuilding. We're not failing. We're
Yeah,
rebuilding.
exactly. It's yeah, it's I and the beauty about San Francisco is the San I love the San Francisco Giants and just being around the stadium. Even it's just the new
Oh, that's
stadiums.
yeah, the ballpark is great. I love it.
Yeah. It's expensive. I'm like, wait,
Oh yeah,
how much is this beer? And I'm like,
$17 cup of beer.
yeah, let me
Seventeen
give you
dollar cup of beer.
I'll give you my kidney for it. No, I
Yeah.
just pour the beer, pour a couple drops of it on my kidney and then I'll put it
Yeah.
back
Can yeah,
down.
can I just get $5 worth? Just like a shot or
Yeah.
something.
Well, do you ever
Yeah.
sneak alcohol into games?
No. I mean, I rarely go. Like, I go
Yeah.
once a season or something, and somebody has a ticket.
Yeah.
But that said, when I'm there, I absolutely enjoy it. It's just I'm not a massive sport guy. I do follow the 49ers. For the 49ers, I follow pretty closely, but I don't watch other NFL games really until like the playoffs. I mean, it's the 49ers. I do like, there's talk radio down here. Is it K
KNBR?
N B C KNBR? I think it was KNBR. And listen to that during the football season. And it's the first year that I started doing that, and I get obsessed. Like on the way to work, I'll put on KNBR and those guys talking about football like wall to wall. And I suddenly became that guy, man. I was never that guy who would turn on the radio and couldn't wait to listen to sports radio. I feel like a weird imposter. Like there's no other, very few of my friends who are all like actors and musicians would they would be appalled, be like, "Oh, what's happened to you?"
I think there's a be the beauty is the storytelling of it. It's the story of the people in the on the team. That's the story when they get
Yeah.
into the stories of it. And
There's
it's
intrigue.
yeah, like I'm totally into the UFC. I don't like myself for this, but I watch
Oh, for
UFC
Ultimate Fighting? I love
cage.
Ultimate Fighting.
Yeah, it's really
Yeah, no,
it's great.
the other thing is that the only sport that I ever did was Muay Thai for quite a
No
few
way.
years.
Oh, wow.
And so I started that in like it, after I was already old, like it was in the late 90s. I started over at Navarro's, which is a pretty hardcore place. Like they try to train fighters to fight, and fight for real, fight professionally. And so I showed up there when I was like 30, maybe, and oh, there's a bunch of kids around. But I really enjoyed it. It's very hard. I've been doing it ever since. Like I did it at a gym probably for about 5 or 6 years. But now when I go to a gym, I make sure they have a heavy bag and do the stuff, and I love it. It's like my favorite workout ever. Yeah, it really is the whole Muay Thai thing. At this point, I don't know if you can call it Muay Thai, but all my moves are Muay Thai based. So,
And when you watch those fights, it's like chess, especially when they're grappling. I'm just, it's
oh
so
yeah.
interesting where it's just like, oh, they're losing their rook so they can get the momentum into the center of the board type
Oh
thing.
yeah. Yeah, well, jiu-jitsu is like that. And I, in fact, I'm envious of that. I've been thinking about maybe trying it lately. But it is the chess of martial arts. I mean, definitely. You have to have a plan. You have to be patient. All that stuff. And I find it, that's why I like UFC, is that, like, clearly for the most part, the strikers are Muay Thai based, because it's a good system. And then clearly the grapplers are, Brazilian jiu-jitsu sort of based. All the other stuff on the sides are useful, but man, you can just, that's basically it. It's Muay Thai and Brazilian jiu-jitsu and UFC.
No, it's so much fun. So what are you working on now? With the fire of this, with the fire burning inside you as a novelist, did you go straight to another novel, or how does that work for you?
Well, as it would happen, and I know that all this seems impossible, but I have a band, and we just were that I put together in the last few years, or last we've been playing for a couple of years, and I wrote an album, kind of a rock opera album, this time without the stage, with this band, and we just recorded it in an actual recording studio over the last couple of months.
Oh,
So
wow.
we're in the final, kind of the final stages. We just got some rough cuts last week, and I'm taking notes about the way I want it mixed, and then we'll have a mixing session. I think it's going to be in September, actually. They're busy over at that studio. But yeah, so that is a big thing, of course. We've been working on that for probably now, I guess it's a couple of years now. Is it a couple of
Are you
years?
gonna do live shows and some touring
Oh
with
yeah, no,
that?
we play live around town now. In fact, I just had a duo acoustic gig with the other partner of the band. His name is JoJo Reddy, and she's the we do harmonies, and she plays guitar. She can actually play some lead. I'm kind of a shredder, actually. So like I come from the whole like hair metal background that moved into Guns N' Roses, that moved into grunge, and so that's kind of where my guitar playing came from. But then I started writing, like, as I've said, a lot of music. But then they are too. So these people, we're old. We're like, I'm 59, and they're all around the same age, but they all rock really hard. They're like, they might rock harder than me, and they're all good at their instruments. And so I'm playing with this band. It's really fun because the pressure's off at this age. You're like, oh, you're not going, I'm going to be famous. You're like, I'm doing this for fun
There's no stadium
and just for
gigs.
satisfaction, That said, you still want to, be the best you can be. And I definitely am, like most things, kind of a control freak about it and really want it to be good.
What's the name of the
But
band?
we're called the Grups. The Grups, which is the contraction of grown up from Star Trek, episode 9.
Oh, the original Star Trek?
Yeah, the Grups. We do it with an umlaut, though, the metal umlaut over the U, which is the inside joke. The funny thing is, we did that, and the too many people are too smart and don't know about the metal umlaut, that it's just a silent sort of affectation, and so people will try to now pronounce the band name, like Groups, like you would do it in German. And I'm like, oh man, this is a bad idea. But we're kind of locked in, and I think it's still funny to put a metal umlaut over you and your band called the Grubs.
I think these guys are from down here. What they're called pigs, 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 pigs. You know that band?
I don't know
But
that
you
band.
have to say it like you have. It's pigs 7 times, and they're very exact about it. So on the radio, they haven't.
This is pigs, 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 pigs. That's
Pigs.
what they do.
They say it like pigs, 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 pigs. Coming up next on KXLU. You're just going,
How
oh, you're
nice.
just,
Okay, so you.
yeah. They're just so specific about it. I haven't
What kind
heard
of
from
music
them
is
for.
it?
I don't even know. I haven't heard from them for a long time. So maybe they just put one record out, and it hit my brain
Yeah.
because of their name. I couldn't even tell you the music. I don't even remember.
So I am working on something which is totally different. Most of my stuff is pretty dark and twisted.
But did you get
This one's
happy? Did something happen and you got happy and now it's going to be
no.
an uplifting tale of
No, it actually hasn't really been a terribly happy year.
Okay,
Actually,
okay.
I mean, all this good stuff happening, of course, is great.
Yeah.
It just happened in a lot of different family turmoil.
Yeah.
In any case,
I
no,
almost feel
it's a
like I
company.
bring the turmoil on my family because and when I do good, everything crashes in my family. And I'm just sitting there going,
No.
I almost want to not do. I'm just like, what's the next shoe to drop when I'm working on something? It's just like there's always tragedy when I have beauty success. I don't know how it links
You
up.
know, I think that it might just be over the backdrop of the success, anything bad that happens is etched more clearly.
Okay, that could be it too. Yeah, because you want things to be going okay so you can really enjoy the success. And then but maybe just life's not okay and that's all right too.
Well, I was talking to a relative the other day, and I was like, sometimes, when you're down, life just seems like a string of tragedies that you have to sort of endure, which is negative. And I actually don't feel that way. Like, I love life, actually. I feel it's fine. It's just, but it's challenging, and you have to keep going and not only see the red lights, So,
Right. And also,
but,
I think being a writer and doing the creation of stories takes us through the human condition in a way that gives us more hope because we're weaving narratives, and I think that's one of the basic things. That's almost like what do you call it? The when they discovered fire, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, what do we do with fire? Well, we tell stories around the fire. How's that? And it's just like we're right there with it, you know. It's an element.
Then also we burn down villages. That's the
Well,
other one.
there's
We can do that one too.
there's that thing. What do we do with this nuclear bomb? We tell stories around it.
Is that is, I'm hearing a phone. Do you hear a phone?
No, I don't hear a phone.
Must
Yeah.
be something on my
But you were saying about the happiness and your next project that you're working on? This utter joy you're having in the middle of the
You know what?
turmoil.
The thing is, I'm having this thing where something is going off in my that was it. It was an alarm, probably telling me to go on this interview.
Now is your
Anyway,
time.
so it's a coming of age story set in 1991, and it's set in Lodi, and I picked Lodi because it's like the closest thing to like a small contained town, like a Midwestern town, but it's in California. There's a thing to it, and plus, like, it's and I've visited and done research there now, and it feels like San Jose in like 1980. It's because it's got this feeling. But also, well, going there was a was like a oh, Jesus, I know who it is. So anyway, it's a coming of age story set in Lodi. It's told from the point of view of this 13-year-old kid. I mean, he's older, but he's talking about a time when he was 13, and his sister, Jane, is 15, and she's kind of like a she's like a Ferris Bueller character in the way that like she just does stuff. It's not funny like Ferris Bueller. It's more serious. But it's set against the backdrop of some heartbreak there, but it's not like the twisted, drug usage and violence that happens in pretty much everything I've ever written. It's sweeter. It's almost, I wouldn't call it a young adult novel, but it almost has that feeling a little bit, and I'm not trying for anything other than I want to tell a story, and it's kind of based on how I used to feel about my sister when we were young. She kind of, my mom was a single mom for most of that, and my sister raised me kind of, she was 4 years older than me, and like, so she was my hero, and I kind of wanted to use the emotionality of that in this story. So it's and I know that you know this as a writer as well, but it's the you have to really want to write a story. Like you can think
Oh,
about a bunch
yeah.
of different stories, but then you have to go like, I'm gonna commit many years to this thing probably, and you have to really be obsessed with it, and I had a number of different stories that, after I finished Imagine My Surprise, that I knew I was going to do something next. And I was like, kind of experimenting with ideas and writing down ideas. And this one just kind of stood out. It's called, and by the way, it's called Jane, the Pirate Queen of Lodi.
Cool, I'm in. I'm
That's the
already
name of
in.
the novel. And
Yeah.
but I'm excited. I'm taking another solo trip next week just
Yeah.
to, I don't know, just have a little vacation. But I'm actually just going by myself. I'm going to stay in Lodi one night.
Yeah.
Look at the neighborhood it's set in, because it's set in a particular neighborhood. There's a other side of the tracks in Lodi. Like, they
Yeah.
literally say that. Like, it's
Yeah.
not a it's and I caught that the first day I was there. When I was doing research, I went into the Chamber of Commerce and started asking questions, and then they asked where I was staying, and I said the address, and like, oh, across the tracks. Oh, on the other
Yeah.
side of the tracks. And I was like, what? And then realized it was. And then the other side of the tracks was the working class, broke down part of the town. And I was
Yeah.
like, wow, I can't believe that's a real thing. And I thought it was just some sort of turn of phrase.
Dude,
And
that was in Millbrae, because we
yeah,
had the
scary. Oh,
Caltrain
yeah, you
going
have the
through town.
tracks.
If
Yeah,
you're on the other side of the tracks, you're in the poor area. Yeah, that was back in the
I never
80s.
knew that was
Yeah.
a thing until then.
Yeah,
In any
yeah.
case, so yeah, so I'm going on a road trip, and I'm going to go there and check it out again. And I can't wait.
Cool, man. His name is K.S. Haddock. The book is called Imagine My Surprise. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming
Hey,
on.
thank you so much, Tony. And thank you. I perfectly timed. I finished my drink in drinks with Tony.
You are listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.